This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thanks for joining us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today, our show is going to start with a book with a title that is Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. And we're going to talk about this with the author, Matty Friedman. He's a Canadian and Israeli journalist, and he's the author of the book. And he joins us by phone from Kansas City because he's on a book tour for the book we're going to talk about. Matty, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Give our listeners a mini biography of Matty Friedman.
I was born in Toronto, Canada, moved to Israel when I was 17, intending to spend a year there working before college, and then got stuck. Never went back home. That was 24 years ago. And since moving to Israel, I've been an agricultural worker. I served 3 years in the military, studied Islamic studies in university, and became a journalist. And that's what I've been doing for most of my adult life.
And for several years, you worked for the Associated Press in that part of the world.
That's right. I worked for the Jerusalem Bureau of the AP for about 6 years and then left to write books. I've written two, and this one that just came out last month is the third.
Well, the book you wrote in 2016, Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story of a Forgotten War, is based on your experience with the Israeli Defense Force during the South Lebanon conflict, right?
That's right. I moved to Israel as kind of a Canadian teenager and blundered into a low-scale guerrilla war in South Lebanon that really kind of shaped who I am. And I wrote a book about it that looks at the experience of the country through my own experience and the experiences of my friends at this very small, strange military outpost inside South Lebanon at the very end of the 1990s.
So you come with this book, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel, with a broad range of experience about what you're going to write about. So tell our listeners, why did you write the book?
Well, I guess there's two reasons. One is that it's a good yarn that I happened upon, and I'm drawn to spy stories and stories of double identity and who isn't. I think that's quite common. So that was the first reason that I was drawn to the story of these four very young spies at the birth of Israel in 1948. And the second reason is that I think this story offers a new an insight into the state of Israel. I think will be new to many people. I think many people know a very European story about the state of Israel, so they might have heard of Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, and pogroms in Europe, and the kibbutz idea, the socialist idea, and the Holocaust, of course. But half of the Jews in Israel come from the Islamic world. They're native to the Islamic world. They come from places like Casablanca and Morocco, or from Baghdad in Iraq. Baghdad was one-third Jewish in the 1940s, and not many people know that. And that population was displaced almost entirely and mostly moved to Israel, where it has really shaped the state that has emerged since 1948, and that part of Israel's identity isn't properly understood. So I thought telling a story about the founding of the state through the eyes of four Jews who come to Israel from their homes in the Arab world, I thought their stories would be an interesting way of talking about what the country is beyond the very simple stories that most people know about it.
Well, give us some historical context here. What was the status of Jews in the Middle East during World War II?
So in the 40s, there are about 1 million Jews who are native to the Islamic world, mostly Arab countries, with a minority living in non-Arab Islamic countries like Turkey or Iran. But their position is eroding in the 1940s with the rise of nationalism, and because the attempt to create a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel inflames a sentiment against them. So these Jewish communities, which are ancient, these are communities that predate Islam and predate Christianity in many cases. So these are native communities that have been in place in some cases for thousands of years. These communities are displaced, and there are pogroms and there are attacks against these people. Synagogues are burned down, people are killed, and over a period of years, the communities kind of vanish and mostly reconstitute themselves in the state of Israel. And today, there are virtually no Jews left in the Arab world, and only a very small number of Jews left in Iran and Turkey. So that whole world, which is a very ancient and interesting world, has been largely erased in our times, in the 20th century, and not enough is known about that.
Well, who were these spies of no country that the book is about?
So the spies of no country are the members of a very small, kind of amateurish intelligence operation that's mounted by the Jewish military underground in what is then called the British Mandate Territory of Palestine in the 1940s. These are kids, basically. They're kids. They're barely out of their teens. Some of them are still in their teens. And they're picked up by recruiters for the Arab section who are looking for people who can pass on the other side of of the enemy line, people who can assume Arab identities, people who have native Arabic, who can bring back good information from the Arab side, which is something that the Jews from Eastern Europe are incapable of doing. So they're picked up. These kids are picked up. Some of them are picked up on the street. One of the characters is selling green peppers from a crate at a vegetable market. They're marginal characters in the country without their parents in many cases, and they're picked up and they're trained to some extent, not very well, but they're trained as spies, and they're dispatched into this incredibly chaotic and dangerous moment in history, which is the birth of Israel in 1948.
Well, who was the Jewish underground representing? What I'm getting at here is we have movies like Casablanca, which kind of portray this sort of murky environment during the Second World War, where some people were allied with the Axis powers, some with the Allied powers. I'm thinking that the Jewish underground was more likely to be allied with the Allies, wasn't it?
Certainly. During the Second World War, the Jewish underground in Palestine is trying as much as it can to help the Allied side. Of course, they're deeply opposed to the Nazis. Many of the families of the Jews in Palestine had just been murdered by the Nazis, and they were eager to get into the fight. And the British were quite hesitant about arming the Jews, because they realized, I think, and they realized correctly, that as soon as the Second World War would end, the Jews were going to start fighting for their independence from Britain, as indeed happened. But some of the British intelligence operatives in Palestine in the early 40s, members of the Special Operations Executive, the SOE, decide that they can make use of some of the Jews in Palestine, because these Jews have double identities. So, for example, you have Jews from Germany who can pass as Germans, and the SOE trains a small group of Jews, which they call the German section. They train them in Nazi uniforms. They train them to sing German military songs, and the idea is that they will operate behind German lines when the German army arrives in the Middle East and conquers Palestine, as it was expected to do in 1941. They also take a small number of Jews from Arab countries, people who can pass as Arabs, and they train them as intelligence operatives. And that is the root of the Arab section. Now, the British and the Jews have a falling out in 1942 as soon as it's clear that the Germans are not going to invade Palestine. So that moment of panic in the early 40s kind of passes. The Arab section is then maintained by the Jewish military underground. And as soon as events come to a head in Palestine in 1947, 1948, when the British withdraw and leave a vacuum that is filled by a pretty fierce war between the Jews and the Arabs, the Jews begin using the Arab section to collect intelligence and ultimately to carry out acts of sabotage and, in one case, an assassination.
So their value as the Arab section was that these were Jews that could pass for Arabs.
That's right. That's right. And ironically, their Arab identities made them marginal in Jewish society in Palestine at that time, because it was so heavily European. And they were kind of kept to the margins, and no one knew quite what to make of Jews who seemed like Arabs, who spoke native Arabic and who came from places like Aleppo, came from places like Yemen. But then their Arab identities became their ticket into the society, because they became useful as spies. So the intelligence operatives valued this identity and understood that it would be very useful in the case of a war against the Arab world. And when that war indeed came at the very end of 1947, the men of the Arab section became central.
Okay, so how would you describe their spy craft? I mean, they had a kiosk in the middle of Beirut. Is that...
I think for anyone who's familiar with the stories about the Mossad and the kind of the mystique of Israeli intelligence, it's kind of a shock to read about how basic, how ad hoc and kind of seat of the pants this operation was. These guys are the roots of the Mossad. They're one of the seeds of what eventually becomes Israeli intelligence, but they're basically untrained. They're so poor that they don't make salaries, and they don't own a camera at first. So when they're sent off to gather intelligence, in some cases they borrow a Minox camera from a civilian, from a guy who they know. And at one point they're told that, you know, they're going on this mission with this camera. If they don't come back, that's okay, but they better bring the camera back so they can give it back to the guy who lent it to the section. When they're sent to Beirut to set up what becomes Israel's first intelligence station, they're sent off without a radio. They don't own a radio, and there's no way to communicate with headquarters. So the thing is very, very amateurish and kind of thrown together in the heat of events and at this very desperate historical moment where they just had to go and they had to do it with tools at hand, and they didn't have didn't have very many tools, and as a result of their poor training, of the dozen or so Asians who are active in the Arab section at the very beginning of the war, half of them are caught and executed.
Wow. So one question I meant to ask is that they were living in this Middle East environment where they looked like everybody else. They had a different religion. So what would have been the specific motivation for these four Jews from Arab countries to do what they did?
Well, they were very committed to the idea of creating a Jewish state. And I think that as a small, kind of endangered minority inside the Islamic world, they understood very acutely that the Jews needed to have a country that can protect them, that they're not going to be safe in amid the majority population, which is a feeling that, of course, the Jews in Europe also have. And it ends up being quite right. So they're very committed to the Zionist cause. They're willing to die for it. Some of them do die for it, and even though they are kind of marginal inside Jewish society. So it's not that they're being treated particularly well, even by their countrymen, but they understand that this cause is necessary and just and worthwhile, and they kind of throw themselves into it in 1947, 1948, and succeed against pretty steep odds.
Well, they've got this kiosk in Beirut, and Beirut, Lebanon would have been kind of a crossroads for what was going on in the greater world in World War II. So they're spying. What kind of sabotage did they commit? And what is this assassination you mentioned?
So initially they're just gathering intelligence, and they'll go into Arab villages and Arab neighborhoods, sometimes disguised as itinerant barbers or peddlers, and they'll chat people up and try to pick up pieces of gossip and kind of bring back worthwhile information. And then they graduate to sabotage. The first significant sabotage operation is the attempt to block a truck bomb that's being built by one of the Arab militias in Haifa in early 1948. Haifa is the main port of British Palestine at that time, and they get intelligence that an Arab militia is preparing a truck bomb disguised as a British ambulance that's going to go off at a Jewish movie theater that coming weekend, and they have to scramble to intercept this truck bomb somehow, and at the time the Jews don't have anything that resembles a military. There's no air force. The only way they can operate is through subterfuge. So they decide to take out the truck bomb with their own car bomb, and
wow,
they have to smuggle it into the Arab part of Haifa and smuggle it into the garage where the truck bomb's being constructed. And it's a pretty dangerous mission that's undertaken by two of my main characters, two spies from the Arab section, and it succeeds. The next thing they do is try to take out one of the central leaders, one of the most important military and religious leaders in Haifa on the Arab side. And that's also quite a complicated operation where they're tapping a phone and they're tracking this guy. And in the end, they try to assassinate him on the road as he's driving back from Lebanon to Haifa, and actually met the member of the Arab section who was in the car. He's the only surviving spy of the four main characters, and he's still alive. He's 94 years old, and he's one of the characters in this book.
All right. Matty Friedman is the author of Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. We'll have more in our discussion of this book with Matty in just a moment.
Where do you listen to Prairie Public? At the lake? In the office? Or maybe tending your garden?
As long as the roots are not severed, all is well.
Maybe you like to listen when you're in the kitchen whipping up something good on an HD radio or a smart speaker. Hey, what's your name? Play Prairie Public. One listener says quality programming pairs well with everything. Hear, hear. Another Prairie Public fan on social media says she likes to spend Saturday mornings in the sewing room learning and laughing with her favorite programs on Prairie Public.
I'm the Hubbell Telescope. Bill Curtis.
Into the Music Man, Mike Olson had fans take him on the beach. Not him literally, but listening on the app.
Surfing's not a sport. It's a way of life.
So where do you listen to Prairie Public? Show us on Facebook. And as we gear up for Prairie Public Spring Member Drive, contribute nice and early to the public radio station that you listen to in a lot of places.
It's one small step for man.
Not yet, but someday. Just go to prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848 and open the link we send you, or you can become a sustaining member online at prairiepublic.org. And thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're talking today with Matty Friedman. He's a Canadian and Israeli journalist and an author. His newest book is Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. And Matty's on a book tour. He's speaking to us from Kansas City. by phone. Maddie, before we broke, you were talking about this car bomb, truck bomb sabotage incident back around the time of the end of the Second World War and the beginning of the birth of Israel. There's some irony that that is the weapon of mass destruction that is still being used in that region.
Yes, there are certain elements of this story which unfortunately will seem familiar to people following the Middle East today. I wish it were different, but there's a lot in that era, in the 1948 era, that that still haunts the region in 2019.
Well, when we think of Israel, the state that was formed in 1948, we think of Exodus and these people flowing into the Middle East from the ravaged Europe and concentration camps and the Holocaust, as you mentioned, all these awful things. But as you mentioned, there were Jews in Arab countries who also came into Israel. Was their status in any way different?
Yes, it was. And if we look at the society today, it's about half of the Jewish population in Israel can trace roots back to the Islamic world. But the state was set up initially by Jews from Europe, and it was set up in large part for Jews from Europe as a refuge for people who had been driven out and whose relatives had been killed in the Holocaust. And they didn't quite know what to do with Jews who came to the state speaking Arabic or speaking Persian or speaking Kurdish. But there was a wave of immigration into the state of Israel as soon as it was founded from the Islamic world, as people were either drawn to this new state by the idea of living in a Jewish state and by kind of old messianic dreams of a return to Zion, which are very important in the Jewish religion. And in part, they were being driven out by violence, by kind of mob attacks, by state persecution, by the nationalization of their property. And there's a wave of immigration into this state, and the Jews who come from the Islamic world are largely treated with condescension, with disdain in some cases. They're kept out of the centers of power for a long time. It's taken a long time to change. It's still far from being equal. But if you look at Israel's political system today, for example, you'll see that Jews of Middle Eastern descent are more and more assuming positions of power and influence in the society. But I think it's telling, for example, that we've never had a prime minister of Middle Eastern descent. So we still have a long way to go.
Well, you live in Jerusalem, which is a storied city, which represents the three major religions, among other things, and is sort of the nexus of conflict in the region. Is Jerusalem, is Tel Aviv for that matter, segregated into neighborhoods of like Jews who immigrated from the former Soviet Union or from some state in Africa at a particular time? Have these cities become ghettoized?
Well, Jerusalem is a unique example because people do live in bubbles, but the bubbles in Jerusalem are not necessarily ethnic. They're drawn along broader lines. So in Jerusalem, you have three main groups. You'll have ultra-Orthodox Jews, and then you'll have mainstream Israeli Jews, and then you'll have Palestinian Muslims with a small Christian minority kind of on the Palestinian side. And people tend to live in their own areas, although there's more and more mixing in Jerusalem. But if you go to a city like Tel Aviv or the suburbs of Tel Aviv or a place like Haifa, it's very hard to know who you're looking at on the street. If you stand on the street and see people walk by, you're never sure if it's someone who's Arab or Jewish or Muslim or Christian or Russian. Israel's a very heterodox society. It's a very complicated society. There's a really interesting mix of people in the society. And you hear a lot about conflict, which is true in some cases, and you don't hear a lot about the kind of remarkable, vibrant life of the country despite all of its complications. Most of the time, people kind of get along and make it work.
What about the Arabs who live in Israel?
Right. So there are different groups. So you have Palestinians living in the West Bank, for example, territories that came under Israeli control in 1967. You have Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem who have different status. East Jerusalem was annexed by Jerusalem after 1967. And then you have an Arab population inside the state of Israel proper, about a fifth of our citizens who've been citizens of the state since 1948 and who are represented in parliament and play a role in the political life of the country. So there too, it's complicated. It's a very complicated place, and you can look at the glass half empty and kind of point out the very real points of conflict and contention, and you can look at the glass half full and say, here's a country that shouldn't work, it shouldn't function, And yet somehow it does. In many ways, I think it functions better than the United States. And it's a remarkable little place, and I would really recommend that you come visit and that all your listeners come to visit. I think you'll find it very interesting.
It does sound like a very interesting place. But did the establishment of Israel, now 70-some years ago, have this ironic effect of making the environment for Jews in the Middle East more problematic? I mean, you can be in one safe place, but you can't be everywhere.
That's right. One of the unintended consequences of the formation of the state was to undermine the position of Jews in other Islamic countries. Now, that shouldn't have happened. There's no reason that the establishment of a Jewish state in the land of Israel should have undermined the position of Jews in Morocco, for example, which is many, you know, thousands of miles away. There was no reason for the populations of those countries to respond with violence and exclusion against their own native Jewish populations. But that is what happened, and the establishment of the state triggers violence and persecution against the Jews of the Middle East, who then are driven out and come to Israel. So it's, you know, the world is full of unintended consequences, and a good thing can lead to a bad thing that can lead to a good thing. It's very hard to know.
Well, you have been in that region for a long time now. You've looked at it from several different kinds of perspectives. So how optimistic are you that in your lifetime, and you got more years left than I do, that there will be some sort of established peace between Israelis and Palestinians that will endure?
Well, I wish I could be more optimistic, but I think anyone looking at the Middle East with their eyes open sees that it's a region of intense conflict and violence, and not just between Israelis and Palestinians. In fact, in some ways, our little corner is less violent than a lot of other parts of the Middle East. If we just go clockwise around the state of Israel, there's Lebanon, which is controlled de facto by the Iranians, and then there's Syria, where 500,000 people are dead in a civil war, and then there's Jordan, which is kind of a shaky monarchy, and then there's Sinai, where there's an ISIS insurgency, and there's Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas.
It's a dangerous place.
So it's a dangerous and unhappy region, and I think that if the regional context were peace and stability, as it is, for example, in Europe, I think that Israelis and Palestinians could make it work. But because the regional context is war, and it's a war that has very little to do with Israelis and very little to do with Palestinians, as long as that's the regional context, I'm afraid that the chances for a durable peace deal are slim.
Well, when I introduced you, I mentioned that you'd spent several years working for the Associated Press in that part of the world. You've been critical of Western media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Why?
Well, I think that there's been a kind of disproportionate focus on Israel. It kind of looms too large in the Western imagination. I'll give you an example. When I was at the AP, we had more than 40 full-time news staffers covering Israel. And Israel is 0.01% of the world's surface. It's about 0.05% of the landmass of the Arab world, 0.2%. But our staff in Israel was larger than our staff in China, for example, which is a country of 1.3 billion people, and we have 9 million in Israel. So I think if you are too heavily focused on Israel, you're not going to really be able to grapple with the real complexities and kind of vastness of the Middle East and of the world. And I think that people attach a bit too much significance to this one very, very small country, and that interferes, I think, with an attempt to rationally grapple with how complicated the Middle East is and how complicated the world is. I also think that journalists tend to lean towards simple stories. They like simple stories. And if things are too complicated, they simplify them, and they often tend to see what they want to see and not see other things. And I think that's true of coverage in Israel. I think it's true of coverage in other places. So, you know, I'm a journalist, and I'm proud to be a journalist, and I know wonderful people working in the industry, but I also have a lot of criticism of the way it works, particularly in the country that I cover, which is Israel.
Well, for our listeners who want to find out about a very interesting chapter in the development of the State of Israel, the book is Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. Matty Friedman is the author, and you can find out more about him at mattifriedman.com. That's M-A-T-T-I. FRIEDMAN.com. Matty, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, Sue Balcom will give us a Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A rural Walsh County man was arrested and is expected to face a murder charge in the death of a family member. Sheriff Ron Juergen says deputies responded to a call from a women's shelter around 10 yesterday morning, alerting to authorities that one of the home's residents, 65-year-old Stephen Ani, was suicidal and there was a fight at the house involving a 36-year-old woman.
The female had already left the residence prior to law enforcement arrival and was transported to First Care Health Center in Park River, North Dakota, by private vehicle.
Juergen says the victim died at the hospital about 90 minutes later of injuries received in the assault. The original call to the shelter came from another family member who was present in the home. Ani is expected to be formally charged in a court appearance today in Grafton. Transportation funding for roads and bridges in Minnesota could be on a collision course between the House and Senate. The Senate has passed a funding plan that does not include a gas tax hike or tab fee increase as supported by the House. Senator Scott Newman chairs the Transportation Finance Policy Committee. Newman says the budget uses existing taxes and general funds to target over $6 billion in the next 2 years.
If we were to take that amount of money, which would total $1.5 billion in the next biennium and $2.5 billion in the following biennium, directly out of the pockets of the people who are driving cars, those are the people that would have to pay this, I think we'd cripple the economy in the state of Minnesota.
Newman says everyone realizes that the state's infrastructure is aging and needs attention. He says the Senate plan does that without raising the gas tax. And North Dakota's deer season has been set, and this year 10,350 more licenses will be given out, bringing the total licenses available to 65,000. Casey Anderson is Assistant Chief of the Wildlife Division with North Dakota Game and Fish. He says in total, mule deer licenses are up by 450, and antlerless mule deer are up by 700. Licenses for antlered whitetail deer are up by 700, while antlerless whitetail are up by 1,250. The category of any antlered licenses increased by 3,150 and any antlerless by 4,100. And in addition to that, muzzleloader licenses are now up by 184, with youth licenses up by 45. Anderson says in recent years, fewer licenses were given out due to thinning herds after tough winters, but the herds have been coming back even after the seemingly rough winter that just ended.
We had a rough winter, but realistically, when you look at it, it was relatively short. You know, we didn't really start getting snow till the end of January. You know, and a lot of times our animals that obviously have lived in North Dakota for a long time, the cold and the snow doesn't bother them in shorter durations. It's when you get those long, seemingly drawn-out winters. Now, of course, it was the worst towards the end, so a lot of us felt like winter was really long. But when you look back at when we started getting snow and the amount of snow that we maybe had on the ground, which impedes movement and animals' abilities to find food, it really wasn't on the landscape for that long.
CWD, or chronic wasting disease, has been found in some sections of North Dakota. Anderson says hunters will be expected to comply with regulations regarding the harvest of animals in those sections. Hunters can apply for licenses online at the North Dakota Game and Fish website, and they are available until June 5th. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And our Bill Thomas joins us again today on our Main Street show to talk about something that is near and dear to him because, Bill, you have been a judge for the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud contest for a while now.
For quite about as long as it's existed, I think. And it is an interesting thing to watch. It just sometimes gives you chills and always leaves you very impressed with the ability of these young people to recite a poem so well. Wow.
Well, and today we have news because today we learned who the national Poetry Out Loud champion is. It's Isabella Callery, and she's from Minnesota.
Yeah, from right next door in Minnesota, and that was interesting to me because I have kind of tracked this over the last few years because I always want to see how the North Dakota person does. And the winner usually comes from the coasts, and I think some of the big cities breed more champions or something, you know, poetry champions. But it's great to see somebody from the Midwest winning and right in our region.
Yes, and Matt Northfield, Minnesota.
Yes, and she is a student of indigenous background, and the poem that she reads is not that, but she did some of her other poems were by Native American authors.
Well, let's listen to Isabella Callery recite the winning poem.
Thoughtless Cruelty by Charles Lamb. There, Robert. You have killed that fly. And should you 1,000 ages try, the life you've taken to supply, you could not do it. You surely must have been devoid of thought and sense to have destroyed a thing which no way you annoyed. you'll one day rue it. 'Twas but a fly, perhaps you'll say, that's born in April, dies in May, that does but just learn to display his wings 1 minute, and in the next is vanished quite. A bird devours it in his flight, or come a cold blast in the night, there's no breath in it. The bird but seeks his proper food, and Providence, whose power endued that fly with life, when it thinks good, may justly take it. But you have no excuses for it. A life by nature made so short, less reason is that you, for sport, should shorter make it. A fly, a little thing you rate, but Robert, do not estimate a creature's pain by small or great. The greatest being can have but fibers, nerves, and flesh, and these the smallest ones possess, although their frame and structure less escape our seeing.
That was Isabella Callery, the 2019 Poetry Out Loud National Champion, reciting Thoughtless Cruelty by Charles Lamb. Bill, very skillful.
Yes, that's a tough poem. We had a couple people in the North Dakota State finals pick that one, and it's about 200 years old or so, Charles Lamb in Britain, so the rhythm of the sentences and the language is not comfortably colloquial to somebody right now, and it takes a good reading to bring the meaning out of it, and she really did it.
Well, I didn't realize that there were 275,000 students competing for Poetry Out Loud at state competitions and ultimately getting to the nationals like she did. That's impressive.
Yeah, and she wins $20,000 too.
Well, that is also impressive. So just remind us briefly of the rules here.
So you recite a poem by somebody else. It's by a recognized poet. You pick from a list, a very, very large list, that the Poetry Foundation supplies. And they go for not very big dramatic readings, but a reading that supports the meaning of the poem. You get rated on things like physical presence and articulation and the overall performance. And you get scored by judges and points, and somebody wins.
Well, congratulations to Isabella Callery of Northfield, Minnesota, the National Poetry Out Loud Champion. Bill, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Yes, glad to be here for poetry.
Coming up, Main Street Eats.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Maw, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available May 3rd at 10 a.m. in person at Tickets 300 or online at jadepresents.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio we have Sue Balcom of the Rootsellers Farm near Mandan. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. You know, it's been a year, don't you?
A year.
Oh.
I've been with you guys.
Did you make us a
cookin'? No, I didn't. But I didn't get like my 1 year award from you either, so.
Well, we were waiting for the cake with the candle.
I see. Okay. And you know the reason I know that it's been a year is because we're going to talk about dandelions again today.
Yay.
What comes around goes around, right?
Well, what do we want to talk about dandelions besides the fact that they're really good for you?
They are good for you, but you got to really, first off the bat, don't kill them. Don't spray them down in your yard. Pick them out instead because they're so good for you. They're good for bees, too, which is really why my husband got on the dandelion bandwagon. So.
Yeah, they're one of the earliest sources of food for bees.
Well, a pollen source.
There
well,
we go.
That would be their food, right? They eat pollen and then they poop and then we eat their, honey.
Thank you.
Circle of life with Sue.
Okay, sorry. That's the way my mind works. So dandelions at one time were actually cultivated in people's gardens or empty plots because they're actually an aster flower family. And so I thought it was pretty cool because in French, one of their nicknames is pissenlit, which is pee the bed.
Peace on Lee.
There we go.
I can't.
Thank you. You know, I'm going to have words, all kinds of words in my lifetime that I can't pronounce because I'm German. And so thank you for, say it again.
Peace on Lee.
Okay.
And there, my French minor has finally come in handy.
So that means it does something then, Sue, right?
Right. It's considered a diuretic agent, which means that it's rich in potassium. And if I remember correctly, they always recommend that you eat bananas before you have surgery because of the potassium that's in them. So you can have dandelions this time of year for free because they actually are out and about. Even though the sun hasn't been out and about for many weeks now, we do have dandelions and grass growing in our yard. But they also have vitamins A and C, and there's so many things you can do with them. Like in the event of a zombie apocalypse and we can't get coffee, which I don't know what I would do without my morning coffee, you can actually eat dandelion or process dandelion roots into a chicory type of coffee, and you can blend that with your regular coffee or you can drink it straight up if you don't want so much caffeine in your life.
I'm trying to imagine this. Do you dry it out and crumble it, or what do you do?
Right. You would dig up the roots and put them on a baking sheet and let them dry, and they will, of course, get really dark. Takes probably 4 or 5 hours in about the lowest my oven can go is 170 degrees, but it's also a convected oven, so that airflow helps dry them out really fast. And then all you do is cool them off because they'll change texture once they're cool, and grind them up in your blender or food processor, store them in a jar. You steep it like tea, about a heaping teaspoon of roots to a cup of water, strain, and add cream and sugar to taste.
Okay. So what does it taste like?
It tastes like a plant.
Because it's not coffee.
It is not coffee. I'm sorry. I don't want to disappoint anybody out there. It's kind of like we've resorted to drinking hot water sometimes when we're at farmers markets when it's really cold out because we don't want the caffeine thing going on all day long. So it's kind of like a It has an earthy taste to it, but it definitely, you wouldn't mistake it for coffee. I'm so sorry.
Well, you have some other culinary possibilities here on your list about dandelions.
Well, you know, you can make a soup out of the greens, and the best time to pick them is now when they're still really small and they don't have a flower on them yet. Like if you go out and look around, they're growing everywhere, and they're growing real close to the ground in May because it's still kind of cold and there still hasn't been any sun. It's been a long winter where I come from. And so you can process some dandelion greens in soup like you would a spinach or something like that. And it's kind of like blended soup, and then you add a little bit of cream to it. So it's basically dandelion greens and chicken stock. You can flavor it with basil or other spices that you enjoy. And then use that cream afterwards. Don't boil it with the cream in it because your cream will curdle. And then garnish it with some nice toasty sourdough breadcrumbs. And you have a healthy, healthy soup.
Now, as a child, I remember biting the stems of a dandelion, and I remember a bitter taste.
They definitely are bitter, and they have that milky substance in those stems. That's why you want to kind of try to get those greens early on before those flowers, before they start budding out. But in the event that you don't get to them soon enough, you can also make fried dandelion blossoms, which are kind of fun and kind of probably unexpected on your plate.
How do you do those?
Well, you would take the dandelion blossoms. The hardest part is trying to convince people to help you harvest them. You know, I'm like, let's go pick dandelions. Really? So you want to pick new ones, you know, that haven't opened, you know, haven't gotten all white and seedy. And you want to rinse them off in lightly salted water. And cut all those icky stem ends off and cut as close to the flower heads as possible. But you don't want the petals to fall apart, so you don't want to cut that end off completely. And then you blot them on a paper towel and you dip them in a little bit of beat up egg, milk, flour, and salt and pepper like you would anything else you were going to coat and fry. And you dip them in that kind of batter and put them in a deep fryer until they're lightly browned. and a little more salt, and ta-da, it's better than fried crickets, I'm telling you.
Well, it sounds better than fried crickets. And, of course, anything fried with batter tastes like something fried with batter.
Yeah. So. Right on. So you could probably get those by your kids, too. Oh, look at those little yellow fried things on your plate.
Well, if you need to gather the dandelions, you know, any child from 4 to 7 will do that very quickly for you.
They'll give you a lovely bouquet
of
them.
Yes, they will.
That's what I need is more little fingers at my house, because it takes a lot of dandelions to do other things. Like you can dye with dandelions, you know, dye fabric naturally with dandelions.
Thanks for that correction.
And then you can, I know somebody told somebody else I dyed one time and they're like, that's really too bad. And she's like, no. So, yes, clarify that. You can dye fabric with dandelion greens. And also, you know, use them for balms and lotions and homemade soap, too. You can make dandelion oil and use it in all those kinds of things. But this would be my favorite, is dandelion pesto, because I love to grow basil and I love to smell basil, but I do not like basil pesto. But you can use dandelion leaves to make pesto also. You can kind of dilute your basil, put some nuts in there, cloves of garlic, a little olive oil, and, of course, lots and lots of good grated Parmesan cheese, and then salt and pepper to taste. And then the best thing is to eat that with other vegetables, like, you know, carrot sticks or celery sticks, things like that.
Delightful.
Now, do dandelion leaves have a sort of a familiar flavor note, something we would have tasted before?
You remember when you stuck that dandelion in your mouth? That
I
would be reminiscent of that.
Okay, well, I'm going to be careful with those dandelion leaves then.
Yes, and like I said,
you have different taste buds now, Doug, than you did as a kid.
That's right. And you're not actually drinking or tasting that milky, you know, bitter stuff. The older they get, the older those leaves get, or the more mature the leaves get, the more bitter they become. But right now...
Sounds like some people I know.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I know people like that, too. I'm going to call them dandelions from now on.
All right. Well, the bright...
Get the young ones.
Embrace the bright yellow dots in your lawn. Don't go out and kill them. Go out and gather them and use them, says Sue Malcolm.
Woohoo! Yes.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week from our Bismarck studio for the podcast Main Street Eats. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
What's happening is next.
Everyone's living on social media these days. And hey, so is Prairie Public.
We love when friends come to visit.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Prairie Public.
They take pictures of themselves, and no surprise, they post them to Instagram.
You'll find television and radio content and behind-the-scenes views of Prairie Public via Facebook Live.
While we're live on Facebook, time for another movie review with Matt O'Lee.
Interact by sharing your thoughts, opinions, and photos. Just not your cat photos.
Talk to Prairie Public. We want to hear from you.
What's going on? You know, it's not just a song, it's a question. It's Thursday. We're looking at the calendar for things to do. Ashley Thornburg and I have come up with a what's happening list.
There is going to be Gary Arbuthnot on stage and screen Thursday. So today in Dickinson at the Dickinson State University Dorothy Stickney Auditorium. He is a virtuoso who has show highlights that have musical scores from contemporary movies, Broadway, opera, some of the biggest rock and pop groups of the modern era. So it'd be sort of like channel surfing on the radio coming all out of one performer here. 7:30 to 9:30 in Dickinson. Again, this is tonight, and tickets are $30.
The big event of the year in Fargo downtown is the Plains Art Museum Spring Gala, and it is Friday at the Plains Art Museum. Live music from post-traumatic funk syndrome, hors d'oeuvres from all kinds of folks who are very skilled at making them. And they've got some wine tasting there as well, a silent auction. Attire at the Spring Gala is often creative, and you're invited to wear whatever will make the event fun for you. It runs from 7 until midnight Friday at the Plains Art Museum. The cost is $100. It's a bit of a fundraiser, too.
Donuts and beer this Saturday the 4th in Grand Forks at the Brick and Barley Bar and Restaurant. This is four unique beers that are going to be paired with Sandy's Donuts. So that's a fun, you know, usually there's a wine and cheese, and now there's beer and donuts. Tickets include a pairing for two people as well, and you will get two beer flights and a donut. And you can stop by anytime between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Tickets are $30. This is Saturday the 4th in Grand Forks at the Brick and Barley Bar and Restaurant.
The musical Mamma Mia takes the stage tonight through Sunday and next week Thursday through Sunday in Fargo at the stage at Island Park. This is the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater's musical. The ABBA music is highlighted in this comedy built around a story about a bride-to-be and the three men who could be her father. It's a 7:30 curtain. Thursday through Saturday with a 2 o'clock matinee on Sundays. The tickets run from $15 to $25.
There is a hands-on art project this Saturday the 4th in Watford City at the Rough Rider Center, as you have the opportunity to make a glass sun catcher. So you know how certain glass just looks so beautiful when the sun catches it the right way. So you get to work with an instructor who will be guiding you through this process to make very personal, meaningful pieces to you. Make your own sun catcher. Take it home with you. Saturday the 4th in Watford City at the Rough Rider Center from 1 to 3 p.m. and it's $50.
The Hometown Stars Variety Show is Saturday in Williston at the Old Armory. We know that Williston is home to some incredible talent, and the variety show highlights all of the talent that Williston has to offer. You will enjoy acting, singing, live bands, comedians, and dancing. The possibilities, well, up to you. Could be quite a variety show. From 7:30 to 9:30 again on Saturday at the Old Armory in Williston, the cost is $10.
Well, we know May the 4th be with you, and so every year, May 4th, May the 4th be with you, and there's going to be a lightsaber duel in Detroit Lakes at the Detroit Lakes School of Taekwondo. Yes, a lightsaber duel. This is part of an event from the world's largest saber dueling organization. And they allow for full contact saber battles with custom sabers and gear. May the 4th be with you, 6 to 8 p.m. in Detroit Lakes at the Detroit Lakes School of Taekwondo, and it's free.
The Mommy and Me Princess Tea Party is Sunday in Grand Forks at University Lutheran Church. This event includes a meet and greet with Miss North Dakota Katie Olson, a light snack of tea and sandwiches, story time with Miss Grand Forks, photo booths with fun props, tea time crafts, and activities and some small take-home items. Princess costumes or fun spring dresses are encouraged. It runs from 2 to 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday at the University Lutheran Church in Grand Forks. The cost is $25.
The Red River Spring Market is this Saturday at the Prairie Roots Food Co-op. They will have spring produce, pantry items, household goods, baked goods, art, food, you name it, all of these wonderful things that will just get you in the mood for those farmers markets that finally, when it's nice enough to be outdoors and have lots of vegetable produce for you. So the Red River Spring Market, Saturday the 4th at Prairie Roots Food Co-op in Fargo, 10 to 2. Free to get in, and then the cost is whatever you want to spend to support local vendors.
A Chili Feed and Country Gospel Night is Friday in Fargo at Messiah Lutheran Church. If you're a fan of country gospel music and chili, and who is not a fan of those two things, then join them for a spectacular event, the best chili this side of Dakota, and it'll be a memorable night with talents such as Meryl Pepcorn, Loy Larson, Greg Smokey Temple, Don Neustadt, Bill Law, and a number of surprise guests. So it's a nice show at the Messiah Lutheran Church Friday. It starts at 5:30. There's chili and music, and the cost is $15. What's your pick this
week?
My
pick of the week is Keep a Bismarck Beautiful this Saturday at North Central Park. Volunteers are asked to clean up Bismarck. As the snow melts, you start to see what's been left behind. Wear long pants and bring gloves. And this is from 9 to noon. And, of course, course, it's free.
My pick is African Sojourn. It's Sunday in Bismarck at Dakota Stage. It's followed by a reception at the Capitol Gallery. This is a 90-minute documentary about African Soul American Heart, a North Dakota-based nonprofit with a mission to educate, protect, and empower orphan girls from South Sudan. Founder and documentary producer Deb Dawson will be present. It's at 3 o'clock Sunday in Bismarck at Dakota Stage. Again, there's a reception at the Capitol Gallery after the 90-minute documentary. It is free and open to the public, and that's what's happening.
Next time on The Pulse, think about all of the things you used to hear about pot.
Marijuana. Pot hurts.
These days,
Acapulco Gold.
You can buy marijuana legally in many places. Use it as medicine. With all of those massive changes have come many new questions that researchers and healthcare providers are trying to figure out. We'll take a look at marijuana and the new normal.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 2nd. The little towns of far northwestern North Dakota have seen ups and downs over the years, but a rich history nonetheless. Towns such as Zoll, Apam, Alamo, and Corinth along the Great Northern Railroad claimed decent populations in their early years, from 100 to 200 people a century ago to only a handful in some places today. It's a remote area of North Dakota, about 30 miles north of Williston, where even radio signals can be dodgy. Much of the local history is rooted in the old village of Cottonwood Lake, built in 1904 on the banks of the lake of the same name. It was renamed Alamo when the railroad came through and the town moved a bit to the west to be adjacent to the tracks. Nearby Corinth sprang up as a railroad town in 1916, as did Apam. Corinth was a thriving little village at first, with more than 100 people in 1920, but it declined over the following decades. Its elevator burned in 1966, and the post office closed on this date in 1969, with mail routed to nearby Alamo. Not long after, in 1970, the Lutheran Church closed. It was much later that Apam's post office closed, with mail also routed to Alamo. Though the towns have declined, memories still remain, along with shuttered brick schools and boarded-up buildings. Signposts in Apam indicate the purposes the building served. The area was featured in a photo essay by National Geographic called The Emptied Prairie. That spread frustrated state officials over its portrayal of North Dakota as abandoned, especially for people who still call that corner of North Dakota home. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Friday on Main Street, we'll talk with James Woolner about his 10-episode podcast, Dakota Spotlight, which looks into the mysterious death of a Glen Ullin man. We'll hear from Moorhead Sarah Trone, who was highlighted during the most recent episode of Public Radio's Away with Words. News director Dave Thompson will review the week's big stories, and Matt Olean will review the blockbuster of right now all time, Avengers Endgame. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.